Welcome to the Cannabis Therapy Podcast. I'm your host, Earl Carruthers, and I have been a serial cannapreneur in the growing, processing, and retail space for over 8 years. And we are here to learn together to get a well-balanced understanding of cannabis and cannabis products. Tune in every week for quality cannabis education for your canna inspiration. We are live.
Okay, I think. Awesome. Oh.
Hello.
That was stressful. Everybody. Technology's.
Welcome to the Cannabis Therapy Show. Camera's here. Sorry, looking at my laptop. Welcome to the Cannabis Therapy Show. We are live, and this is the Cannabis Therapy Podcast. I'm your host, Earl Carruthers. Been a cannapreneur for almost 10 years now and growing, processing, and distributing cannabis here in Michigan since around 2009 when Michigan passed the Medical Marijuana Act, actually 2008. But this is a Cannabis Therapy Podcast Show. We're here to talk about cannabis from a therapeutic point of view, whether it is history, science, the business, advocacy, all that jazz. And this is our cannabis segment. The cannabis segment is actually for budding entrepreneurs. Ha, 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 no pun intended. Budding entrepreneurs looking to get into the industry or who are in the industry so that we can get a better understanding of how the industry can work and how we can fine-tune our skills. And today we have a great show. This show is How to Succeed in the Marijuana Business. We have some great guests as well that we are about to introduce. We are live, so this is a show that you can actually interact with. You can talk in the comments, by all means, anytime throughout the show. Give us a hello. Let me know if you guys are out there watching. Say what up, though. That's what we say in here in Michigan, Detroit. Say hello to me as well. And as we go through the show, if you have questions, we're going to try to answer those questions. If it's related to the slide that we're on, we'll answer it right then and there. If not, towards the end, we're also going to have some time for some Q&A as well. Without further ado, I think it is time to get into the show. And I am, boom, there we go. I'm about to do a nice introduction of everybody. Let me unmute everybody real quick. Boom, unmute, boom. Okay, all right. Everybody should be unmuted. Technology, we should got this.
Earl, what's up, man?
Hey there. All right,
cool. Hey. Let me introduce Jeff. I'm going to do Jeff. We got Amanda and we got Yolanda. I got some biographies. I'm going to read them out just to be nice and proper here. First, coming out the red, we got Jeff. Jeff Welsh is a partner in a Vincente Sederberg. When I say Vincente, a Vincente, it sounds like this, there's a Cuban restaurant in Detroit called Vincente.
He's half Cuban, so you got that.
I would say you're a smart guy. You're right on point.
I keep thinking tapas whenever I say this, but Jeff actually focuses his practice on advising companies, brands, entertainment and media properties, other law firms and investors on how to navigate the California cannabis marketplace. He's recognized as a thought leader in a California and entertainment communities. Jeff frequently speaks at cannabis industry events throughout Southern California. Without any further ado, what up though, Jeff?
Hey, Earl, how's it going, man? Pleasure to be on the show today. Really excited for our chat.
Awesome. And to my top right there in the corner, we have Amanda. Amanda is That's a senior cool. associate attorney at Vincente Sederberg, again, tapas. But she is in Los Angeles office, where she focuses on real estate and land use law, corporate law, and licensing. She has advised developers, assisted the preparation of environment impact reports, and represented financial institutions in a wide variety of real estate secured financing. That sounds fancy, Amanda. Very fancy.
That's right. I wrote that myself.
Prior to joining VS, I like VS. VS is a nice short term for
easier.
Amanda operated a small private practice advising clients on aspects of medical marijuana industry, including employee handbooks and contract zoning, municipal code compliance, cultivation, wholesale, distribution, and health. That's a whole lot, Amanda. What up, though, Amanda?
I need to update my bio, I think. Let's condense this.
It sounds like you're like super, You're the superwoman of weed right now.
I'll take it.
And we have Yolanda in the bottom right. We got over there. Yolanda Clark is associate attorney at VS Denver office, Denver, Colorado. She has snow like we have snow in Detroit, so she can relate to that. The people in California, we're not even going to talk to you right now. Where she focuses on licensing and regulatory compliance. Since joining the firm, Law Clerk, in 2016, she has assisted licensing applications across the United States in California, Colorado, Florida, Louisiana, Maryland, Michigan, Missouri, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, as well as International Canada. All right. With those introductions, hello, everybody.
How's it going? Hi, Peter.
All right, so we have a good show. We are about to get into the topic of how to succeed in competitive marijuana business licensing. I am simply just a driver. I will ask questions. Uh-huh. Jeff, Amanda, Yolanda, you guys, it is your show, and you are welcome to start this off. And I'm your slide guy. I'm going to help guide this through the presentation. I'm going to ask questions as well as bring up some of the audience questions as well. Cool?
Cool.
Beautiful.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Earl. Yeah, we can go to the next slide, Earl, if you don't mind, buddy.
Yes, sir. I work for you.
So thanks again, Earl and his team and everyone that's tuning in. You know, we want this to be a collaborative conversation. We're going to cover a lot of things at a high level today. It's impossible to cover everything about, you know, cannabis licensing in one, you know, webinar. So my goal and our goal of today is to really give you sort of a high level overview with enough information to hopefully give you some direction into where you'd like to proceed or move forward with. And then after that, of course, you know, we'd be more than happy to chat with you following the podcast. So I'm sure Earl, the team will provide, you know, some contact information for all of us at the end. So who are we, right? Vicente Cederberg is the nation's preeminent cannabis and hemp law firm. You know, we have offices in Denver, California, New York, Boston, Jacksonville, Florida, and we just opened up an office as well, a small one in Austin, Texas. So I believe that we're the nation's largest cannabis and hemp-focused firm, around 55 lawyers and 30 staff. And you know, one of our favorite quotes to date is, you know, Rolling Stone actually called us the country's first powerhouse marijuana law firm. So this is what we do. This is what we eat, sleep, and breathe is cannabis and hemp. And yeah. Next slide would be great. Thanks, Earl.
Cool. Gotcha.
So at a fundamental level, right, when we sort of trace back to the origins of the why, right? Why did Brian Vicente and Christian Cederberg start this firm? It really boiled down to letting patients have access to the medicine that they need, right? As this industry has evolved, you know, I think everyone certainly on this call, and I'd imagine a lot of people watching, are firm believers that something like a plant shouldn't be federally illegal, right? But the origins of really, you know, why we really got involved in this industry stems from the fact that cannabis has many legitimate medical uses, all of which, you know, should be recognized. And patients who need cannabis for those medical uses need easy access to their medicine. And so that's really, you know, as it relates to the why, right? A lot of people ask me, you know, why did you, you know, start, you know, working in the cannabis field? My goal is and always has been to help, you know, decriminalize cannabis in the average consumer's mind. And, you know, we take a lot of and put a lot of responsibility on our shoulders to help, you know, effectuate, you know, meaningful change on a daily basis.
That's what's up. But now, when I actually got, now we talk about why it matters too. I'm actually got a question. Sure. I feel like we almost always get into the business side of things. We talk about the why, but it's on a personal note. I feel like first and foremost, it's like we want to stop arresting people, prosecuting people for a plant. Is that kind of in line with your guys' company vision as well?
100%. Go ahead, Yolanda. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think for so many of us, that really is why we got into this business. I know I'm from, I'm originally from Chicago, and I grew up in Baltimore. And, you know, the really frank and obvious differences in enforcement between marijuana smoking from white teenagers in those areas and black teenagers in those areas was astonishing. And it's upsetting. It's not the way that our country is supposed to be run, and especially on the basis of bad science. So there's really no reason to continue a failed experiment that was, you know, really from the beginning should never have occurred. And it has. And you know, millions of lives have been infected and impacted, and all of the repercussions throughout those family systems. And it's time to really make a change and turn that around and make this an industry that really benefits everyone, and especially those communities that were so disproportionately impacted by these punitive drug policies.
That's what's up. And then, I'm sorry, go ahead, Amanda. Were you about to say
something? The only thing I was going to say is that I feel like Yolanda and I are always using the term the failed war on drugs, and that really, really highlights it as well.
Yes, yeah, it's one of the wackest things ever in the history.
Correct.
But with that said, there's, you know, when there's sometimes obstacles, there's also opportunities, and that leaves a business opportunity. And I believe you're going to kind of touch on right now kind of why now is the time also, as we're trying to untangle that war on drugs, there's also a time now to kind of get into the industry. Can you kind of speak to that?
Sure. Essentially, you know, and it's crazy, right? Because California passed, you know, the nation's first medical marijuana law in 1996, right? Which is a long time ago. And we've seen, you know, an incredible evolution. We are nationally so far past the tipping point, right? Both socially and politically as it relates to cannabis. And since we're now at this time and place, economic opportunities are now, you know, becoming more and more robust with each state that opens up, right? You know, back in 1996 or even a couple years ago, there weren't that many opportunities, and the opportunities that did exist were so expensive, they were almost prohibitively expensive to get involved in, right? Because a certain state might legalize cannabis for medical use or even adult use, but there might only be a couple licenses in the state, right? And so it was a monopolistic program that was sort of, you know, written out, which only really allowed Earl the Rich to get richer, right? Mm-hmm. And now we're at a point. I can't say it's perfect. You know, all of my work is in California, but just from, you know, being in the space and knowing what's going on in other states, it's certainly not perfect. But that's one of our other jobs too, is to work, you know, with clients and help illuminate these opportunities for our clients and help show them that it isn't just about you know, the rich getting richer anymore. There are more robust opportunities for really everyone to participate at this point.
Yeah, and I can speak further, you know, to kind of California specifically. So every locality basically has an opportunity to set up their own social equity program. And we've seen kind of the spectrum of things. So in LA, if you want to apply for a storefront license, you need to partner with a tier one applicant and they get 51% of the business. Now, then there's other cities like Long Beach would offer technical support or financial resources to help these smaller businesses kind of get up and running. So they're like Jeff said, some localities are doing better than others. And but it's really nice to see that people who might not have the opportunity to have a cannabis business are given this helping hand.
And I'll also say, you know, from the beginning of the industry, you know, there really weren't these conversations. You know, Colorado, where I'm at, was one of the first states that passed adult use. And we didn't really have those considerations because it was just such a big deal to get, you know, adult use passed in the first place. And getting more into the social equity was a non-starter. But now that people across the nation are getting more, you know, comfortable with the idea, both medically and recreationally, you know, we're starting to be able to have these more nuanced conversations and really get to the heart of the matter.
It's such a good point, Yolanda, because, you know, it really reflects kind of the personality of the city when you see, you know, some locale, and I'll just say this, like Culver City, for example, no social equity kind of like component, but then there would be something, you know, some cities that might, I don't know if it's more progressive, like absolutely require, you know, this social equity component or will like award points for that sort of thing. So it does, it is interesting to see where cities stand on these issues.
Yeah. And they're usually a reflection of, you know, the political sphere within that city, right?
That's it. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Reflection of the political and social landscape of that exact city. So, you know, larger urban cities have to do, in large part, a better job of incorporating meaningful social equity programs. Mm-hmm. California, you're doing a good job. Some are not.
Some are not.
You guys all kind of hit on some good points. I mean, talking about it being local, and then of course in Denver, you just want the fact that, oh shoot, it's legal, whatever. You know, but now as things progress, you see now it's like you don't have to just settle for just let me just say, you know, weed's legal. Now it's like, okay, it's legal, but and we want social equity, and we want these type of records being expunged. So I feel like the laws now are kind of, you don't have to just settle for just any kind of marijuana legislation. It seems to be robust, but also the key thing is for us to not to look at, because you guys mentioned local a lot. It's not just, you know, well, it's the state, but really where you live in that city, you can really lobby to really get opportunity. It's not just, you have to leave it up to the city, it sounds like. Is that, or leave it up to the state. You can really change the social equity program in your local city versus trying to fight or lobby the whole state.
A lot of that will depend on the specific state you're in. Some states have more local control. So those municipalities do have the power to put in their own ordinances to mandate social equity and other kinds of things. Other times it's limited to just what, you know, general kind of business things. So like zoning, they can do certain zoning things, but you know, they cannot require any kind of social equity piece. So that's why it's always really important to make sure you're paying attention to, you know, where in the world are you? You know, what state are you in? What locality are you in? And what are the specific rules for the program for that area?
And in California, you know, having these ordinance passed at a local level, it's a 2-year process. So yeah, Yolanda's right, I'll start with zoning and taxes. So there's like many different steps and all these different kind of ordinances that will be passed. So I've absolutely seen, a local operator or a big multi-state operator be participating like from the very beginning with these, with the localities, with the city council and the planning commission to make sure that, you know, their voice is heard. And honestly, I think more often than not, the city's like quite receptive to like hearing what people have to say, because they're all very new to this. And so they actually don't have that much of a knowledge base on how to run a cannabis like program. So I find that they are pretty receptive.
Awesome. Now some of these cities or some of them may opt in and have different type of businesses, may not have allow all the type of businesses, and kind of Jeff, are we going to touch on kind of what are some of the direct marijuana businesses that you can actually kind of get into if they do allow licenses?
Yes, sir. And look, I mean, you know, if you're involved in the space or you're dipping your toe in the space, you're probably aware of these. And so this is, you know, obvious. I think the point I specifically want to make right now for people who are trying to figure out how they're going to get involved, my best recommendation, Earl, from being involved in the space for 10 years is stick to your core competency, right? Find something that you've done in your prior career, because you probably haven't been operating in the cannabis space, at least exclusively, your entire career, right? In which case, if you've never grown a plant in your life, you probably shouldn't be a cultivator, right? If you don't have any retail experience, you probably shouldn't be a dispensary owner. I would just say find, like, for me, it made sense, right? I went to law school, right, to be an entertainment lawyer, and then I discovered cannabis. So it was a natural expansion into cannabis. I have people who, come from the entertainment world, right, and wanted to get involved in cannabis. They're like managing cannabis talent. And that, we'll talk about that on the next slide with ancillary. But I would find
the closest comp you have from your traditional space. And you might not have one. And in that case, you might have to get creative or talk to people and figure out how you can get involved or get experience and actually work at one of these facilities, just like you would in any other traditional industry, right? If you think you might be interested in cultivating, get a job, you know, at a cultivation facility and figure out if you enjoy it, right? I would say the one thing I've seen too much is people that are focused and set on a specific type of license. And when I try to peel back the why there, the layers, they don't have any experience. Look, the reality is our space is becoming more competitive. And if you don't have any experience in something, unless you can actually sell that asset, if once you get it, you know, and make a profit that way, you know, the reality is you might be looking at, you know, you might be spending a lot of time, effort, and money into something that's not going to be successful. And so that's just a practical piece of advice for people who are not yet involved in the space who are tuned in.
No, I concur. I mean, if you don't like people and selling, you probably should not be in retail.
Right.
Yeah. Now, for the rest of this conversation, or as we go on, I know some people wanted us to kind of talk about the cost of growing. So a lot of questions later on, if you guys are still watching this live, and again, you can always answer or ask us questions in the comments. I will be asking more questions on the cultivation side. So I'm a dive, not really get into the testing or to the dispensary or to making the products or the transportation. So personally, I have a personal agenda myself, just to ask you a bunch of questions about cultivation.
Understood, buddy. No, Yolanda and Amanda are, you know, this is what they do all day, every day. So, you know, I've got tons of cultivation experience too, not personally. So next slide here, this is kind of to my point earlier, right? If you're looking to get involved in the space, find out what your competency is, right? You know, a lot of my friends and colleagues in the industry are on the ancillary side, right? And this kind of speaks also what level of risk you're comfortable with. The level of risk at this point is becoming less and less meaningful a conversation, just because, you know, where we're at federally, but there's still certain groups, right, that won't get involved, right? Like Fortune 500 companies are not to get involved in the space until until cannabis is descheduled or legalized in some respect. And so on the ancillary side, ancillary is just a way of participating in the space with a little less risk. So you could be, you could be someone like myself, a lawyer, business services, like, you know, also known as consultants, right? If you're someone that has a lot of experience, but doesn't necessarily want to be operational, it's a really good way to get involved. I have several clients that make a killing off of just wholesaling equipment to people who have incredibly successful businesses.
Security is a big one too, Jeff.
Absolutely. And
software systems,
Is there anything else that like is not mentioned on there that you would say is a good entry point?
Honestly, there's so many contractors that you need to really have a successful business. You know, something that often I think it's omitted is educational consultants, right? Especially on the dispensing side when you're going to be interacting with the public, but also on the cultivation and processing side, you know, your staff, just like so many other businesses, they are the ones that are in there doing the day-to-day hard work and making sure that your business is successful. And if they're not properly trained up, not only do you run the risk of, you know, a poor, you know, customer experience or things like that, but you run the risk of significant legal and other ramifications for not properly, you know, tracking the plants or, you know, not inputting the things that are supposed to be input by law. Like those have very serious and costly ramifications. So if they're not trained properly, you're going to have a bad time.
Awesome.
Yeah. What's ironic is, so next show, in January, I wanted to actually take a deep dive into ancillary businesses because of, a lot of times, you know, we look at, you know, it's kind of like when you're growing up, I want to be, you know, a football player, a lawyer, a doctor. But there's so many other things that you can go into. Like,
there's
a lot of millionaire electricians. Like, no one said you should go, you know, be a tradesperson. So like,
on that point too, you know, something that I think often gets lost is obviously we're talking about operations, but there's so many people that really contribute to submitting a competitive and winning application itself.
Yeah.
So, you know, you need all of the architects and graphic designers who are going to make plans really readable. And so the regulators and evaluators who are, you know, scoring your application understand what your plan is and can really internalize that and give you a high score. You know, yeah. We see like if people try and cut corners on the application side of things, you're not going to get a license. Just you're not, because you really,
and some localities are, sorry, Yolanda, requiring now often requiring security and safety consultants to submit their own plans. So that's like, yeah. Those can be hard to find and can,
yeah. Professional fire.
Fire, life and safety.
Life,
yeah.
And water sometimes. Yeah. So there's a lot of like very niche specialties, that, you know, there's a ton of opportunity there.
That's what's up. That's what's up. Now, what kind of risk is it, whether you are directly dealing with the plant or you're indirectly dealing with the plant? Like, what is some of the, I guess, risks that people need to kind of be conscious of?
Sure. We covered a couple of these already, but, you know, federal law is relevant, particularly if you work for like a government agency currently, right? And are trying to, maybe your side gig might be starting to get involved in cannabis, you know. Private employers can still, in your employment contract, you know, say that you can't, you know, have any other involvement in a business that's illegal federally. That would be cannabis, right? And so those are the considerations. We've, you know, 2020 has been a year of seeing political power shifts. You know, obviously, you know, Biden and Harris, you know, will, you know, we worked with them on their campaign, and hopefully we'll see them, you know, effectuate some changes that relates to the decriminalization or descheduling of cannabis altogether.
Thank you for your service, by the way. Thank you for your service.
Absolutely. No, ironically, Earl, not to get political, and I'm certainly not a Trump supporter in any respect, but it was ironic seeing how little, like, he didn't do anything to benefit our space, but he didn't do much to hurt our space specifically, which was just, yeah, I'm not a Trump fan in any respect, but
you're really driving that home point, that point home, Jack.
I like it to be very clear where I stand. But it was just an interesting side note there. But Amanda or Yolanda, you want to talk about just, you know, how changing regs can affect risk and also cash is specifically to
go first, Yolanda.
Sure. I'm laughing because this does come up quite frequently. You know, this is a really interesting area of law. And, you know, one of the reasons I got into this field is because, you know, a lot of law comes from precedent and it has been really relatively established for the past hundreds of years. You know, there's not a lot of new developments. Maybe there's some specific case that comes up that's new and exciting, but largely, you know, things are relatively settled. You know, you have precedent to follow. Here, every single thing is new. And as Amanda kind of alluded to earlier, a lot of the times, you know, these are very well-meaning people and they want to do the right thing for their communities, but they just, you know, it's a new industry and there's a lot of nuance to it and there's a lot of moving pieces. So we fairly frequently see updates to regulations at a far faster pace than you do see in other industries. And it's a risk for the business. You need to make sure that you have excellent compliance team on staff and that people are really monitoring this, because if a regulation changes and you're not aware of it and you're operating under, you know, last month's regulations, you can be fined, you can be cited, you can lose your license. So it's incredibly important to stay on top of those kinds of things. Uh-huh. And another risk I'll mention too, which sometimes does, you know, gets lost in the shuffle, I think, and it is kind of a loaded aspect of this, is immigration policy. You know, this is a federally illegal substance. And, you know, for those who, even if you're legal green card holders and legal immigrants, there can be risks at the federal level for your involvement, either as an owner or as an employee. So it's really important that you're really staying cognizant of these various differences.
And actually, to that point, Yolanda, we have an operator in LA who purchased some trim from a cultivator in San Diego, and the distributor was, you know, there's a border checkpoint in between San Diego and LA, and they stopped him and they confiscated all of it because it was the border security is federal and they have that discretion. So yeah, it's, you know, these kind of, those sorts of, like, especially if you're living in a border town, the sort of issues you have to consider can be, well, maybe you didn't even think that would be a risk when you started, you know, and then they're coming up. So you're right. It's like be always being cognizant.
That's good. And just
this to, like a very fast pace.
Go ahead, Earl. Sorry, buddy.
No, I was going to say it's a very fast pace. Like the landscape seems to be changing.
Yeah.
So quick.
I mean, by the day.
Yeah, it's like dog ears, man. It's like dog ears.
Dog ears. Really, I love it.
Yeah, because even here in Michigan, before it became state regulated, you know, it was kind of medical caregiver self-regulated, mm-hmm. and it was different from city to city. It could be raining on one side of 8 Mile, and then the other side of 8 Mile would not be raining, meaning it would get raided on the other side of 8 Mile, but on the other side of 8 Mile, mm-hmm. it would be okay. And so it's so these change in regulation. No, I'm just curious from a cost perspective. See, how can I ask this? How can you answer this? The average cost, I guess you say, just to try to stay compliant. And I'm gonna ask this from a cultivator standpoint. I don't understand the difference between different businesses, but from a cultivator standpoint of staying compliant, usually that's because of plant numbers, maybe changing in air quality, something like that. Is that like a monthly cost that you would have to be conscious of? Or yearly, or someone like on staff that's a salary position? Like, what's the typical cost of just focusing and staying on top of regulations and compliance?
I'll answer that high level, and then I'll let Yolanda and Amanda get more specific. I would say it's a little both, right? You have monthly fixed costs like utilities, right? That are just kind of part of your cultivation. So the amount of that is going to vary depending on the size of your cultivation. And then you have more annual costs that will be reflective of like local annual fees, state annual fees. And then look, you know, it's you're growing plants, right? So things are going to break. You're dealing with moisture and humidity and heat. And so you're also going to have like ongoing repair costs as it relates to, you know, keeping the facility up to date. As far as compliance, though, I think those are usually more annual fees. There's just a great range. Since I know this isn't like any state specific, it just might be hard for, unless Yolanda or Amanda, you think you can get a little more specific there.
Well, I think it depends on the size of the operation, right? So like if you're a larger operation, at some point you're going to have to hire a compliance manager, and those people can be making $60,000 to $100,000 a year. So, you know, that's kind of a, you know, a cost, a continued cost. And Yolanda brought this up earlier. It's about the training. And so as regulations change or the local ordinance changes, you're going to have to, you know, retrain your staff. So there's costs associated with that as well. But yeah, I guess beyond the compliance costs, like there are just, you know, Jeff brought up the state and local fees, but there's also, you know, monthly costs associated with the lease and things like that. So it's not always as I think people, when they think of cannabis, they think like, oh, it's this green rush and it's so easy to make money. But in this kind of recreational world, it's the rules make it, you know, cost prohibitive in some cases.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a misconception. I was just going to say, there's definitely a misconception, I think, and I think this stems from its, you know, previous illegality. You know, some guy just put it in his basement and he did just fine. And so they think, therefore, I can run a licensed cultivation facility, no problem. And, you know, among many differences between, you know, your basement and an actual facility, you know, there are regulations. There are numerous, actually far more regulations than a normal business of this stripe. Like if you were growing potatoes, you would not need quite as many people on staff.
Or security cameras.
That's a new movement, Yolanda. That is a new movement. Regulate weed like potatoes. That is what
I trademark this here.
Yeah.
but it is, you know, like you have to have, depending on the state and the locality, you have to do certain numbers of inventory audits. You know, you have to do certain numbers of things at certain times. And if you don't submit that report in a timely fashion, you can get fined or lose your license.
Or lose your license, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Now from Now we're talking, we're going to touch on 280E for a second too, and of course handling cash, but from all the different businesses that's actually dealing with cannabis, whether touching it or not touching it, where would you say cultivation is as far as risk compared to say the other businesses that's directly touching the plant?
I would say, you know, as far as legal risk, I would probably say dispensaries have the most legal risk because they're public facing, right? And it's not necessarily legal risk as much as it is operational risk. You know, dispensaries are the places that I see are the subject of theft, you know, or burglary most often. As far as legal risk, I think it's somewhat tough to put that. To say that one licensed cannabis business is more risky than the other, at least in the eyes of the federal government, they're all illegal. So, but I would say as far as practical general risk, cultivation isn't, look, a dispensary has a cash register, right? And like a vault right behind it. A dispensary usually isn't, you know, we have clients that have, you know, 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 square foot grows, right? Now there's some cash on site there, but that might be hard to find, right? Whereas a dispensary is usually 2,500, 5,000 square feet, right? It's like, hey, there's the dispensary, there's the cash register, there's the back room. That's where the cash is, right? So I would say, or it's a really good question, but I would say overall, as far as legal risk, I don't see a big difference between cultivation or, you know, dispensing or manufacturing.
Okay. Yeah, I'd agree.
And then from the from the 280E perspective, I would say, I mean, would you say that, I hear in theory that of course the best position is to be vertically integrated because you can grow, you can process, you can retail, and you can write off some of your cost of goods sold if you're retail down to the grow. But if you're just a grow, have you seen businesses that have came around time to file taxes that a cultivator has been in a better position tax-wise versus a retailer or the whole vertical integrated? I guess from a risk perspective, from the tax perspective, who would you say is in a better position or maybe has the most risk from the tax perspective?
Sure. You know, I'm not a tax expert, but have.
I was like, I cannot answer this at all. Not even a little bit.
I would say comfortably, you know, the dispensary is the hardest as far as if you're just a dispensary, that's more challenging than a cultivator because there's a lot that goes into cultivating cannabis, right? And my first recommendation, no matter what, is find a great CPA, and we have great relationships here and throughout the country. So you really, really part of your core team, and we'll sort of talk about this later as far as like how you really build a successful application. You're a cultivator, you're looking to apply for a cultivation permit, find a law firm like ourselves and find a CPA who can work together with a structure that the CPA can bless and that the lawyers can bless legally to maximize your ability to get write-offs while being compliant with 280E. But the reality is, so like 280E means you can't write off your cost of goods sold, right? Dispensary owners, like they don't have any cost of goods, right? Like they basically most of them, if you're not vertically integrated, are receiving products and then putting it on shelves. There is no cost of goods sold. So dispensaries get hammered on 280E. Cultivators a little less so. So if you're a cultivator, you're in a better position with 280E, but I just want to be super candid. Like I'm a corporate IP, you know, regulatory lawyer, but I'm not a 280E expert. I have some great recommendations for people in California. I'm sure Yolanda does, you know, for other states, and Amanda does as well. So I wanted to answer the question, but you know, it is slightly I always want the blessing of a CPA on that side.
You kind of answered that question in the same way you answered the Trump question.
I was just going to say, you know, we're talking about costs a lot, and it's definitely something good to keep in mind. Again, I'm not a tax attorney, and there are ways to minimize what you're going to owe, but it is just generally speaking, you are going to be paying more taxes for operating in the cannabis industry than you would for a similarly situated industry. So,
absolutely.
Keep that in mind for your financing.
Now, not to discourage people from, maybe we're talking about the risks. I know we're talking about the tax liabilities and things like that, and what can kind of, and also the cost of staying compliant. But I mean, there are some businesses that are still able to get through all that and succeed. And kind of what is your guys' kind of tips of or ingredients to actually succeed in this industry from a broad perspective, and then kind of more towards the cultivator as well?
Sure. Amanda, Yolanda, I'll let you guys tee this one up.
Sure. Do you want to go first, Yolanda?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm like, me.
There's a couple of different things. And like I often think about this, and I do a lot of licensing. So working on obtaining licenses for clients who want to be operational in places. So that's really a lot of where my focus is. So I do kind of think about it as almost twofold, right? You know, you need to, the first ingredient that you need is an incredibly well put together application, especially, I mean, more and more places are moving to kind of more open licensure. So, you know, we call it kind of like check the box. Like as long as you satisfy all of these requirements, you will be able to get a license. And, you know, whether your business succeeds or fails is up to the market and your business decisions, right? But the more traditional in this industry, and what we still see a lot of, is competitive licensing. So that means that they're only going to issue a very limited number, or maybe slightly larger for some localities, but, you know, they're very competitive. You can have thousands of people applying for a couple of dozen licenses. So you really need to make sure like that you are going above and beyond to really put your best foot forward. And because you might have the best operations, be able to grow the best weed anyone's ever seen, but if you can't translate that into a written plan to show the evaluators that you know what you're talking about, you're not going to be able to get the license, and you're never going to be able to get your product on the shelves.
Yeah, so, I always say it's like a beauty pageant, right? In a way.
Yeah, really. And then the second portion is also like, you know, obviously your actual operations, like it needs to make sense. Like it's crucial to the business. And licensure is a big portion. That's why I just always like to call attention to it, because ultimately, no matter how good you are, if you don't have a license, you can't, you know, share that with your community.
I got to start watching more beauty pageants.
Earl, I would say, and I would just add to that, that one more thing that's fundamental to me as far as your ingredients to success kind of goes to what I talked about a little earlier, is team, you know, like who's on
your team. Yeah.
And it doesn't mean your direct partners or, you know, that means the entire team, right? Not to pat ourselves on the back, but having a good law firm can really expedite the process and make it a lot easier. A lot of people think lawyers expensive. A good law firm can get something done for actually much cheaper and faster than if you did it by yourself, because you make mistakes, right? A lot of people, you know, just generally can be penny wise, pound foolish, can be worried about spending an extra 10 grand, you know, to have a lawyer bless an application. But if that means, you know, if the lawyer blesses your application and gets your application improved instead of it being delayed and hung up because you messed something up, that could mean you could be operational months before you otherwise would have been. But more fundamentally to me, the most successful businesses I see are people that have great core teams, right? So where everyone knows their role. It's just like using a sports metaphor. Any great team, you know, everyone fills a specific role. And it doesn't mean you have to have 15 people on your team to be successful. Some of our most successful clients in California started off with two people, one person who was cultivating and another person who was sort of like managing logistics and back end. And that was it. And now they're 200 person businesses, right? And so it's finding that person that's a complement to you, someone that you can trust completely, and hopefully someone that you have worked with before in some capacity. So I would just say 100% agreed with everything Yolanda just said, but I would say, you know, you can't do this by yourself, no matter how accomplished or skilled or educated you are in the space. And so you really, really, that would be my number one recommendation, like follow your core competency and then build the best team you possibly can.
Absolutely. And it's always important too, you know, we're talking about how things differ between states and different localities. is really making sure that you're aware and up to date on what's important in the place that you're
operating. Totally.
So if your town or wherever you're at really cares about environmental sustainability, maybe you think about adding someone to your team that has a background and will help, you know, your greenhouse run more efficiently, or, you know,
maybe, or they really care about creating jobs. So you make sure to promise to commit 80% of the jobs will be local or something like that. Right.
Yeah. So you just always want to really keep in mind where you're at and what's important to that community. And then obviously the other thing is making sure that you're sufficiently capitalized to do what you're saying you're going to do. We see that sometimes is a huge flaw, is like, you know, the application might require that you show, you know, X amount of money, let's say $500,000. But if you say that you're going to need, you know, $2 million to build your facility and you're only showing them $500,000, like, you're going to have a bad time. So making sure that you know, really build up your pro forma in a competent way to make sure you can sustain your operations.
And I have one thing that's kind of specific, but at least in California, property is like one of the most important like things that you're going to really want to secure. So, and you know, Yolanda mentioned this before, but a lot of cities will kind of determine where, you know, a cultivation or a storefront can be placed based on zoning. So, and it might be quite limited. So, and then if you're doing a competitive license application, your location is really important, especially for storefronts. You know, they want a place that's going to, you know, if they want to make this neighborhood more walkable and you're building a storefront right there, then they're going to give you more points for that. So I find that securing a location tends to be like one of the biggest kind of big ticket first items when looking for an applicant, you know, when looking to pursue a license.
So, something you guys kind of touched on some of the topics we're going to touch on in just a few too, but those are all great tips. I love it. It's
we get carried away.
No, I love it. There is no controlling them, Jeff. There's no controlling them at all. But I'm curious now, because when we're saying, I mean, I hear the word, you know, that you got to get to the table first. So it's still competitive. You got to get a nice application, a beauty pageant. You got to look good out there. But at the same time, you got to be able to have a good facility. You just can't look good. You have to answer some questions intelligently if you're going to really win this pageant. So can I ask for a number here? I know I'm not trying to put you on the spot, because I just said I'm not going to put you on the spot. So technically, I didn't put you on the spot. A number as far as, okay, I got to put in this application. Let's use the example for cultivation. I got to put in this nice application. I need this amount set aside. I know I'm going to have to do this facility. And usually to meet the requirements, we're going to talk about requirements next. But to meet all that, what is a good number? Because if you don't have the capital, Yolanda, you mentioned that you're undercapitalized. I guess, what is a number that someone should be expecting if they're really going to succeed in this industry?
I would say all in, you know, all in. This includes application, lawyers, you know, lease. I would say minimum six figures, no matter kind of where you're at in the country. Mm-hmm. In California specifically, I'm usually all in, you know, $200,000 to $300,000 all in. That's everything for a license. Have I seen clients get fully operational and licensed for less than $100,000? I have, but it's just not the norm these days. And look, because we're not trying to sell, you know, license applications. I want to arm whoever's listening, you know, with just the information from my experience. So, and our experience. So Yolanda, Amanda, feel free to, you know, add to that. But that's typically kind of where I see California, you know, cultivation kind of falling in that range.
Yeah. And I, you know, this is maybe a little more lawyer answer, but it depends.
Yeah.
Is it really like, you know, and we're seeing more of these kind of micro license types, which I think is a really wonderful opportunity for people who don't, you know, have $20 million hanging out in a bank account to get their foot in the industry. Because, you know, if you're going to do, you know, 100,000 square foot cultivation facility, yeah, you're definitely probably looking at least a six figure spend. Just for the land and the build out and the applications and employees to handle all the plants that you're going to have, things like that. You know, but if you are in an area that is offering micro licenses or just the smaller tier cultivation, I mean, I think that that's a really great opportunity for people, you know, kind of more, you know, your average citizen to kind of get involved in the industry, because you can do it with under $1 million.
And the only thing I would add too is that, you know, that's for general applicants, and the kind of the analysis would be different if you qualified as a social equity applicant. So you might be able to partner with someone who's like fine, well capitalized, even though you're not, or, you know, depending on the locality, they might offer like, you know, oftentimes you don't have to pay the application fee, or they provide technical assistance to help you, you know, complete your application. So I think they're
down for you.
They're helping to bring your cost down. That's right.
Okay. Yeah, we got about 11 minutes left. Then I'm going to kind of do some Q&A. But I'm going to kind of, you guys touched on a lot of the topics we're going to talk about now. But as far as, no, it's all good. It's all, you know, I'm like, hopefully I'm not coming off rude when I say that.
No, not at all. I'm just like, oh, I'm
never, we got to have ourselves. Never going to podcast ever again. Such so with the requirements, with laws, regs, application, what would you say would be one of the number one things that, I guess, reasons why people get denied from not understanding some of these requirements, whether it's the law, whether it's the regs, or it's the application? What do you say one of the most important things you need to understand is for?
I'll say right off the bat, you have got to read the application very thoroughly. And not only the application, you have to read any FAQs they provide. Mm-hmm. You have to read everything that they put on their website. If they have public meetings, you want to listen in on that. You want to get the agenda. You want to get the meeting minutes. Because we have seen so frequently that people get disqualified because there's a line requirement that you must provide some form, or you have to write the file name for the submission in a certain way.
And the corporate documents need to be notarized, or, you know, some random thing that is.
We've seen people spend lots of money on applications, but then they didn't get the cashier's check. They just got a regular check to actually pay the application fee because they didn't read it.
It's a nightmare.
And they're standing there at deadline without the right check. And there's nothing to do about it. So you have got to read the application very, very carefully. Like critical.
I'm having some terrible flashbacks, Yolanda, from previous experience, because we've been through a lot. You know, we pull it out in the end, but honestly, it's so stressful. Like,
well, and sometimes, you know, frankly, we're working in Georgia right now, and we are less than 2 weeks away from deadline. And for the past 2 days, the state has uploaded new forms at midnight. So we are, you know, we're adjusting to that. And it's if you weren't monitoring that situation carefully, you might miss the fact that the forms have actually changed that you need to submit. So it's always really important to just be, you know, constant vigilance is the name of
And I have a slightly different experience because in California, at the state level, at least, it's not competitive. If there's a situation, so I think the difference is if it's a competitive license or if it's not a competitive license, and whether you're a social equity applicant or not. So at the state level, if you know, a client uploads X, Y, and Z, but the CDFA, which is Cultivation Regulatory Agency, they're very specific about their premises diagram. So I will go through two or three rounds with them before it's exactly what they want. But they would never deny me for that. They would continue to work with me, and that's because and I think that is because of the non-competitive nature of it.
Yeah.
So
and
that's one difference.
Once you get licensed, even in these competitive areas, a lot of the times, you know, the regulators are more than willing to, you know, work with you. But because it's competitive, and because they're, you know, I'm sure a lot of the people on the webinar today, you know, are aware of the many lawsuits that are out there regarding licenses and various. You know, they are willing to work with you once you get past once you actually get licensed, even in competitive areas.
Okay, no, that's man, you guys are really earning your paycheck over there.
tell my boss.
Now, Amanda, you also talked about location.
Oh yeah. When I was talking about it earlier, I was like, I remember there was a slide.
No, which is good. Well, I guess my question is that when you're actually getting a location, and say you're looking for cultivation, because when you mention the word, like if you're getting a pair of scissors at Home Depot and it may be a dollar, but you're going somewhere else at a hydro store, the same scissors is like $10 only because you said the word weed to it. So when you say locate, like, do you typically have to disclose what you're going to be doing at your local? I don't know. This is going to be
100%.
Yeah, no, this is a great question, though.
Yeah.
This is definitely something that we always walk through with our clients. One, to Amanda's point, you have got to lock down a location. And the earlier that you can do it, usually is better, because there are going to be some sort of restrictions. So they're called, you know, sensitive uses, covered uses, things like that. But usually there's some sort of restriction, and it might be 1,000 feet, it might be 3,000 feet, but you can't locate near a school, or maybe it's a church or religious institution. Maybe
or a library.
Library. And that's why, you know, again, it's, you have to know your locality to know which uses are not permitted. But then you also have to actually find a property that's compliant with those. And sometimes there are very limited numbers of properties that are actually like legally permissible. Mm-hmm. So those, you know, immediately will get snapped up at a very high premium because people are hoping to open. And one of the best ways, and something else, which is kind of coming up on this next slide or two slides, or no, next slide. Anyway, but is meeting your community. You are, if you get licensed, you're going to be operating a business. You need to know your neighbors, and you need to start getting a kind of good relationship going immediately. So, and you need to be upfront mm-hmm. with property owners, especially if you're planning on leasing a facility. You need to be upfront with the owner of the property, because almost always you're going to be required to submit a landowner authorization, which basically is an acknowledgement from the landowner that they are aware that cannabis activities are taking place on the property. And if you can't get that because you haven't been upfront with the landlord, you're going to be in a bad place.
The only thing I would add to that was wonderful. Is that, you know, in California specifically, right, for cultivators, right, I get a lot of calls. Hey, we want to get a cultivation license. Okay, let's help you move forward. So the one thing that I always sort of emphasize is what are the tax rates locally, right? As far as the overall cost, right? Because you might have, like in California, there's a lot of cultivation opportunity in what we call the desert of California, right? Palm Springs area, Cathedral City, Desert Hot Springs, places like that. And each one of those cities has their own separate tax rules specific to cultivation. So not only do you want to find the best, you know, the best opportunity for your building, but you also want to consider those taxes. And kind of zooming out even further, I have a lot of clients who've been able to actually effectuate tax changes themselves because they either had prior relationships with someone who worked in the city or ingratiated themselves to local city officials by being good citizens, right? So as a cultivator, be a good citizen, right? You know, and what does that mean, right? That's a nice word. What does that mean? It means figure out a way to contribute to, you know, some city programs that you believe in, you know, help improve the optics of the cannabis industry by, look, everyone's here to make money. That's all well and good. And that's what we're here for too. And to make the world a better place. To make the world a better place, that means actually walking that walk, right? And so you can really, really, that's that the most amount of change I see is at the local level. And so, you know, definitely want to be mindful of local tax rules and, you know, local real estate cost, right? A city 10 miles away might have a much more affordable cultivation location just because they're desperate to get, you know, cannabis businesses there so they can generate tax revenue, right? So that just kind of, I think that kind of brings that slide home.
That's what's up. A library though, 1,000 feet. What are they gonna walk out with a book?
Yeah, that's a restriction in LA. Yeah.
Like, good Lord, you gotta keep safe at the library. Come on, kill it. Now, Jeff, you mentioned earlier too, like part of the plan, some of the ingredients of success is having the right team. Would you have any tips on kind of picking that team?
I do. You know, if you don't know it, and it's okay if you don't know anyone right away, you know, there are now multiple, you know, basically headhunting agencies for the cannabis industry that are legit, you know, and so if you're looking for cultivators, there are multiple groups, that you can look for that are like cannabis hiring agencies, right? And these are people that are vetting, you know, people to come in. In an ideal world, you're bringing someone onto your team that you kind of know and have worked with before, but that's not the practical reality for a lot of people, you know? And so in that case, you know, try to don't just take a phone call from someone and say, okay, let's do this. You know, you kind of like vet your teammates and team members. And most importantly, I use this analogy too much, but date before you get married, you know, relationships.
Yes.
You know? Don't become a partner with someone and don't become a 50-50 partner with a bunch of signed agreements with someone who you've never worked with before. You know, you can do shorter term contracts and see if it's actually going to work out with them for a future longer term relationship. But, you know, find the best teammates you can. If you don't know where to look, you know, you can just look online for like cannabis, you know, hiring agencies and go through there and talk to them. And yeah, date before you get married, man. That's an important
one. Love it.
Shoot. And then call their mom and call their dad. And then, yeah. Yeah. People crazy, man. It's like business is easy until you get people involved.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Now, you guys talked about, community and part of the application, really getting to know the community and actually, following through on what you would do for the community itself. Have you seen any examples of successful applications and someone who actually had a part of the application or plan, such as giving back to the community, that people are actually doing that? Or is it more just kind of just talk the talk?
No, people, they follow through. I mean, not everyone, you know, there's always going to be bad actors. In some places, you're absolutely required. Community service, you have to do it. In other places, it's squishier. But I know we certainly try and align ourselves with people who are going to follow through on what they say. You know, we've had clients, you know, with this COVID stuff who have converted some of their facility space to produce hand sanitizer and hand those out to first responders, you know, things like that. You know, they do, you know, park cleanup days, you know, Thanksgiving food drives, you know, all the kind of things that, you know, you want to see businesses, local businesses in your community kind of giving back, you know, the ones who are going to sign on to support, you know, the softball league or whatever's important in your area and your community. That's really what you just want to be engaged. You want to be an engaged civic member in your community. Mm-hmm. And there's really often, you know, especially at the local level, sometimes at the state level, but really in the municipalities, as Amanda kind of referenced earlier, you often have an actually like a great opportunity to really impact the regulations that you're going to be operating under. Because these are people who are new to the game and they need guidance from people who actually mm-hmm. understand the industry, and they may not have that knowledge. So by going to community meetings and, you know, the city council meetings and things like that, and just getting to know the people in your community who are making moves, like you can really build good relationships that are going to help your business be successful.
I got one great example of that. Yolanda's spot on. You know, one of our tremendous clients in California, when COVID hit, Earl, turned their manufacturing facility to a hand sanitizing facility, right? And started producing hand sanitizer, which they provided to the local police department and local fire department for them to distribute to their citizens, right? That's going the extra step, right? And they've really ingratiated themselves with that community. And again, like, optics are important, man. We still have an uphill battle as it relates to people on the outside looking in, you know, saying, oh, you're in cannabis, you're a bunch of lazy stoners, you know, like you're not.
How dare they?
Information to the contrary, right? A lot of times I see in our space, it's really an industry where change happens one person at a time still, whether that's someone who sees the medical benefit of cannabis once they or one of their family members get sick and they actually see that it helps. Or in this case, the community seeing, wow, a cannabis business was providing, you know, hand sanitizer to the community. That's just that's so crucial. And right. And I think it's those moments that you know, we hope our clients view as opportunities to really help, you know, kind of help, you know, push us past the tipping point to where cannabis is just acknowledged as a very important part of our community and our culture.
Wow, we got Jeff likes to keep making these drop the mic comments. I don't know. it's kind of going full circle to what you guys start off with, which was like what matters, right? And it's kind of like we're still, first and foremost, let's end this war on drugs, the whole stigma that has came from this awful lie. And that's a great example of how a business can incorporate within their requirements of their plan to still help end this war on drugs. And that's
amen.
And to that point, Earl, too, we see a lot of our clients more and more getting involved in the expungement events and funding, programs and helping cities and local governments, clear some of those records that frankly shouldn't have been there in the first place, but certainly shouldn't now that, the laws have changed. So that's another great way to get involved in your community is to, get involved with record sealing or expungement clinics. Technical legal term, so it'll depend on where you are, but those are really great places to get involved as well.
You gave me a thought. You guys should have like a Vincente Tapa Community First Award. I just do a little in Cuban food. And so then like, whenever you're going to like these dispos or your clients and they're giving back to the community, like you know who to support, right? It's like you almost know who is part of the Better Business Bureau. Like they got a sticker, but if you're part of the community first. All right, I don't know. That's another thought.
I love that. No, that's great.
Now this word here, I'll be honest with you. I was sitting here like, what the compilation? I had to Google this. I was like, man, what the hell? The result of producing some. So I don't even have a question on this. I guess, what were you going to actually talk about this?
I'll this one. This is from for application purposes. And this kind of goes back to making sure that you are reading your application very, very critically and in a very detailed manner to make sure that you don't mess anything up. Because, we could sit here for a whole webinar and I could tell you about all of the horror stories where people are pouring their heart and soul into these applications, long nights for weeks on end, and then some small component of the just submission to the regulatory body to get the gets messed up. I mentioned the cashier's check, and it can happen all sorts of different ways. If it's an electronic submission, the PDF has some error in it and it's not visible and it gets corrupted on the way to the submission. If it's a physical submission, if you're actually printing binders, I can't tell you the amount of times that people will underestimate the amount of time it takes to actually print out 700 pages of information and put it into a binder and turn it in. When we did Louisiana, we had to submit full tax records. So we had, when we submitted and you had to do I forget how many copies it was, we had like 40 banker boxes worth of information for one submission. And obviously that took an immense amount of time to print out, so it's just really being mindful of not only creating this beautiful submission package and like really highlighting the strength of your operations, but also making sure that you're just hitting the practical requirements. Like you have the check in the form that they want, you're giving it to them in the form that they want, it's 12 point font Times New Roman, because that's what they said that they want and not something else that you think looks better. You just have to be really detail oriented. And I've seen so many people stumble at that finish line, and it's truly heartbreaking when that happens. So I just don't want anyone out there to run into that. So read carefully, everyone.
Manifestation. Awesome. Awesome. All right. If you guys out there still, you got any questions, we can answer maybe a few, but I do want to plug in real quick how you guys can get in contact with Jeff, Amanda, and Yolanda.
With
you guys' application questions, because it definitely seems like you're going to need them to get involved. Even for the sake of, it sounds like, someone said, you should have a community program. I would have been like, hey, everybody at the bus stop, get free weed.
I'd go for that.
No, not that. Don't do that. Don't do that.
No. Which is why you should call Vincente Sitterberg, because give out free weed at the bus stop. And then of course we got the slide show notes. You guys can go to campustherapynetwork.org to get the slide notes as well. Crowdcampusclub.org if you're looking to join a private club here in Detroit. And we come up with new episodes every month. We primarily on YouTube for the Campus Therapy Podcast. And then we got the little opt-in. If you guys are looking at the craft movement, go to Craft Cannabis Club. We got a free book to talk about the teachings of craft cannabis. And last but not least, myself, promo. We talk about the cost of actually growing because we actually have the first homegrown weed summit we're doing at the end of January, which is the summit. Hot watches, you ready? It's the first and only summit in the world dedicated to teaching you how to grow elite cannabis at home. We talked about the cost of cannabis as far as getting to the business side, but we're going to talk here on the Homegrown Weed Summit more about how to grow elite cannabis at home. It's not just one person talking. It's 25 different, because everybody thinks they grow the best weed.
Everyone does. Like,
if you grow the best weed ever, yeah.
No truer words, man.
You know, like you can have the ugliest kid ever, but your kid looks the greatest. You know, and to you, it's all good. You're beautiful kid to you. Beautiful. I've seen some ugly babies, but your baby is cute. But yeah, so everybody's going to teach their method, their technique. There's no dogmatic thing. And if that method works your scenario, great. But there's no egos here. So that's a Homegrown Weed Summit. So other than that, yeah, Amanda, Yolanda, Jeff, this has been awesome.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate that.
This was fun.
It's been a pleasure. You have our support forever. So any questions, reach out. Anyone watching, please feel free to, you know, reach out with questions. You know, we're here to help everyone. And we really take that to heart. So Earl, this was awesome, man. Thank you for leading such an awesome little dialogue here. I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Awesome. And now we can leave on this note, just answer this question, and we'll let Jeff answer it last because you know he's going to do some kind of special.
Don't put that pressure on me, man.
But if there's one thing that you could change or do about the war on drugs, what would that be?
I mean, remove cannabis from Schedule 1 and off scheduling entirely. I mean, I think that's it's boring, and then, but it's not number one.
and then move right on to doing the same for psilocybin.
I love that. Yeah. I would say going last, I would immediately release everyone who's currently incarcerated for possession or a nonviolent drug offense.
That's good.
Awesome.
Can I change my answer to that? I like that better.
Yeah. All three.
All three are good.
I love it. All right. Thank you guys for joining, and thank you guys for watching as well.
Thanks, Earl.
For the Chemist Every Podcast. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Yolanda. All right.
Appreciate it.
Bye, happy guys. Holidays,
everyone. All right. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Cannabis Therapy Podcast. For more cannabis therapy blogs and resources, check our website, cannabistherapynetwork.org, cannabistherapynetwork.org.